Well, the only thing I've got in common with Mr. Ant is that although I knew him from the 80s and interviewed him and Marco so many times, but like myself, we both had highfalutin things about Hollywood, and we both had the same acting trainer. What was her name? A lovely lady. We both used to go to a house in Maida Vale to be trained for Hollywood. And the only claim to fame I've got is that I made 5 dreadful films in Hollywood. He made 3, and they were worse than mine.
That's saying something.
And I am the worst actor in the world, and God, I mean, I think the only one of us who ever did anything was Luke Goss, and was it Luke or Matt? I can't remember. The one who did all the B-movies, but at least he did something.
And he was in The Matrix, wasn't he?
That's right. In fact, he's done quite well. But
Can we run through the titles of the movies you might have been in, Steve?
Would you rather not? If you'd rather not. I did the best film I ever did was with Roger Corman. I met Roger Corman and did and it was called Hollywood Boulevard 3. And I played a gangster in it, and I was absolutely fucking awful. I did Martians Go Home with Randy Quaid. And I remember I had 3 lines to do, and I had about a month off work to learn it. I was on the stage, on the set with Randy Quaid, and I went to pieces. He knocked on my dressing room door, and he just calmed me down for an hour. I just couldn't. I was so awful. The worst one, I did one for CBS. And then the worst one was Secret of the Ice Cave, which was shot in the Chilean rainforest.
The Secret of what?
The Secret of the Ice Cave. It's all on Google if you really want to. You can't get to sleep one night. It's on there. And I played this drug-running Cockney idiot, a part that required no acting ability at all. And the final scene was me dying. It's a long story. And I remember the director, Gabru Radiel, it was a Canon film. When I did my scene, he walked over to the fence in the field and put his hand over his mouth and was nearly sick. And I remember thinking, I can't act at all. And I was back in England in about 3 weeks.
But you gave it a go. So
yes, I did. But if I'd done my class like I should, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to the likes of you, John. I'd be in Hollywood. But I was stupid.
No, we'd still be talking. No, we probably would never have met.
I'm stuck with you now.
Yeah. So, a couple of great stories. You've just messaged me before.
Well, okay. The Spice Girl story was a bit limp because I can't tell it in its fullness, to be honest. So,
for litigation purposes.
Yeah. even though it's sort of 21 years ago. So, at the ripe old age of 18, I joined EMI Records, and in January 1977. Some white label pressings arrived in my office. I was disco promotion of Diana Ross's Love Hangover. And I put it on, and I turned my speakers up, and I'd managed to wangle some really good speakers. I mean, Celestians or something, sort of stuff that the A&R chats on the top floor had, because I said, look, I'm disco promotion. I have to play stuff loud. I have to really listen to it. I blasted out Love Hangover, and I flipped, and I didn't stop playing it for about a week until I bored everybody to tears. And I took it home, played it with my mates, and I said, I've got to get this out to all the DJs on the mailing list. I mean, the phrase database had never been heard of. It didn't exist.
For litigation purposes.
Stuffing records in envelopes, sticking labels, typing labels, sticking them on envelopes, sending them out to the DJs, getting reactions back. If they didn't send a written reaction back about how much floor filler potential it had and what they thought of it, they wouldn't get next week's mailing. That's what kept them on the hook. Anyway, about a week after we were listening to this and then saying, well, it's a great dance track, but obviously that won't get played on the radio. We waited for the 7-inch edit to come in for radio. It came in and it was really good, but not a touch on the 12-inch. Anyway, someone then strolled into my office and said, oh, Diana Ross is coming into town tomorrow. She's at a bit of a loose end. She's not doing any promo that first night. Would you fancy taking her out? And I said, yeah, okay, fine. And then the next morning I came into work and I thought, hang on, I'm taking Diana Ross out. So I went back to the person, asked them, I said, well, when you say taking out, what have I got to do? He said, just entertain her, you know, just, you've got an expense account, just entertain her. So I got a car around to her hotel and called up to her room. She came down with Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson, and they jumped in the limo with me, and I took them to Gulliver's Club in Mayfair, which was the smallest club in the world. If there were 50 people in there, it was like a sardine can. 30 was busy. And the DJ was called Graham Fatman Cantor, and he really knew his soul music. Anyway, I strolled in with these three superstars, walked up to his booth, gave him this white label and said, just stick that on, will you, Graham? Trust me. And he did, because I was always giving him good tips. He put it on, turned it up. There was about 35 other people in there, all black dudes. And Love Hangover came on. And I'm dancing on the floor with Diana Ross, Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye. And that's the truth at 19 years old. And they and she said, Greg, this is fantastic. This is the first time I've heard it in a discotheque. You know, literally since I've cut it, I've just listened to it at home or in the studio. But in the, and then people in the club were so cool, they didn't bother her. I mean, a couple of people came up and said, you are Diana Ross, aren't you? And she went, yeah, and Marvin and Smokey. And of course, there's not a single bit of photographic evidence because we didn't have phones or cameras. But and the next morning, someone said, well, what do you do with her? And I told them, and they said, oh, cool, that's fine. And we put it out, and it was a huge smash. And one of my favourite records to this day.
That's a great story, man.
That's a brilliant story.
What year would that have been, Greg?
That's a brilliant story.
Say again, Mark?
What year would that have been?
So that was January or February 77.
Right, wow.
Yeah. Because that it was released, I think, in February 77. So it must have been a few weeks before it was released. Yeah.
Can I just go from that topic, gentlemen? Lem, a fascinating story, really, walking in with three legends. That must have been amazing. What about yourself, Lem? Did you socialise with the Stones or any of the other bands you worked with, or was it just work?
No, it's mostly just work. We socialised on the road, but when we got back to London, I never saw any of them, really.
What year would that have been?
Mostly working.
What year would that have been?
So no big mates, really. I know you worked with the Stones and a load of others, but it was just work, really. You didn't really become mates with them.
No, not really. No, sorry about that. Sorry, no funny stories, nothing.
Have you stayed friends with people from the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, from a distance. I mean, we Facebook each other, or we you know, occasionally send messages, but otherwise, no, not really. I don't see any, no, especially now, at the moment, not being able to go out. I don't even get to go to the Waffle, as you well know.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a different thing. And what about you, Dave? Do you still, are you in touch with the people, all these great people you work with?
Well, no, I'll tell you what, actually recently, very recently, John and I had met up with the very lovely Jackie Hyde at Sony. And we were just sort of talking, you know, a little bit about the old days or whatever. And the one thing that I certainly can testify to, and it was so great to hear her admit to this, she'd been incredibly close to Billy Joel. She'd worked with him dozens of times. She'd done dozens of releases, all sorts of events. And as far as she was concerned, they were quite good pals. And I can honestly say I've worked with hundreds of artists that I always thought I had a really good relationship with. But the truth of the matter is, I think, didn't she say, John, that, you know, she bumped into recently and he was like, well, who are you?
Yeah, he seemed to suffer from total amnesia that they'd had spent so much time together.
They're also busy. They don't remember us, to be perfectly frank.
No, I think if you've ever been in artist relations, as you have, David, and as I have, I mean, you know, I had Julio Iglesias flying into town first time in England. I had Prince first time he came to England, and it's, you know, they're either fabulously confident and they come with a huge entourage, or as in the case of Prince, I went to the wrong airport to pick him up and he made his own way into London. but that's another story. but you begin to realize after doing it for a number of years that they are just passing through your life. All they care about is the limo there? Am I being looked after? Is there a reasonably good after show party? Is my record a priority, in inverted commas, or at least the managers will be asking that. And then they move on to the next city. Now, in that circumstance where they know they're only ever going to be with you for 72 hours, for example, the ones that stand out are the ones who really actually behave in a very friendly manner and respect what you do in the back end for them. You're only one of 10,000 employees around the world helping them have a hit. But Christopher Cross, Randy Crawford, there's maybe five or six, seven artists I've worked with who treated me with total respect. And I, as a result, worked my ass off for them. And that's what artists don't understand.
Yeah, they don't understand.
Go on, Mark, sorry.
No, they don't understand that record companies are made up of people like all of us who were happy amateurs. We didn't do marketing degrees. We didn't do music management degrees like young people can do these days. And so the artists that I worked with that really understood that it's about relationships were the ones that had the lasting careers. You know, U2, who I know that a lot of people don't like them, but U2 were absolutely amazing to work with because they built relationships with, as artists, not just the management, but they built relationships in the record company. And they were incredibly grateful for the success that they had. Mm-hmm. And they realized that, in fact, that success was based upon relationships. You know, if you had a difficult record to plug for U2, like The Fly, the first one off Actum Baby, the only song that U2 ever released that didn't have a chorus, you know, you carried that record into whatever it was, for me, international marketing meetings, or you carried it into Radio 1, but you carried it in with a passion for the band because they had seemingly a passion for you, and it made a huge difference to how people were motivated. And the miserable ones were the ones that just didn't kind of get the extra effort, and that's
or they just thought they were owed, you know, they expected you to bow down, and you know.
Yeah, but the weird thing is, though, if I might say before I forget, Dave. The weird thing is that we do with famous people, for some reason, when you say, oh, I met Phil Collins the other day and he said hello, well, so they should. We, for some reason, I don't know whether it's because we're English, we expect famous people to be twats or cunts. We just do, because of our strata, because it's the way that we are as a nation.
Yeah, we're hierarchical.
We're class-ridden, so therefore, when someone famous is nice to us, we say, wow. But of course, they should be. They're just people.
Yeah, I mean, with a lot of them, it goes to their heads. But with a vast majority of them, they are still pinching themselves, going, I can't believe how lucky I am to be.
Absolutely.
Give me one story that I think encompasses everything you've all just said. So this is a bit of fun, and it crosses music and film. But I was looking after Andy Williams, and I'd worked very closely with Andy, probably five or six times, had got on really well with him. And he was here socially because he plays tennis with his pal who owns Caesar's Palace. And they were in the Boltons, and he called me up, and I said, oh, I'll come over, and we're chatting and all the rest of it. Anyway, that week I was looking after Shirley MacLaine. And she And I said, oh, look, I've got Shirley in at the moment. This is a Wednesday. On the Friday, I said, if you want to come, Shirley's at the Palladium. Why don't you come? And we've got a party. That'd be great. She said, well, can I go with you? I said, yeah, by all means. So him and I took our little Barry Hirst limousine to the Palladium, walked in the Royal Box and got a standing ovation, which I have to say my ego really enjoyed. And anyway, so we go backstage afterwards, and Andy meets Shirley because they'd not met, and Warren was there, and they were all there. And I said, look, we're all going to go down to the White Elephant on the River for this party.
Yep.
You know, we're all in black tie. So you come with us in the limo, if you like. So, oh, okay, fine. So we all go, and off we go. We get to the party, and the party's going really well. Everybody's there. Dustin Hoffman's there. There's celebrities everywhere. And I'm thinking, I'm about 24, I think, at this point. And I'm thinking,
well, I'm you're in heaven.
I'm friends with everybody. I mean, I'm friends with Andy. I'm friends with Shirley. And I've met Warren. And Donald Sutherland's there. And Dustin Hoffman's there. And I'm standing at the bar. And Donald Sutherland comes over to me. And he went, hi. And I went, hi. He went, yeah, a gin and tonic, a vodka. Me, that sums up everything about that day. That is
a brilliant story. And if I may just tail end that very quickly, nothing as good as that, Dave Beeching, but I had to interview Hall & Oates. And at this time, it was in the Hilton that I had to meet them. And at this time, my show, the MTV show, was big in America. This is like 84 or 85, whatever, and it was kind of big there, and the cameras were rolling, and the setup was I was to meet them, and as I walked in, Daryl Hall stands and said, "Fuck me, it's Steve Blacknell," and it was like, and looking back at it now, it's like, what? How can? So it was a reverse sort of thing. Daryl Hall, who's one of my heroes, going, fuck me, Steve. Only because I was this silly person on the telly. So it's kind of weird. Steve, but that's nothing like yours, Dave. I'll take your story.
My sport is Formula One, and I ended up managing a Formula One driver for a while, which was interesting. But years ago, when Damien Hill was world champion, he moved to Ireland and was Bono's next-door neighbour. Yep. And backstage at Slane Castle, after one of the U2 gigs, he was there, and I was introduced to him. And it was quite difficult talking to him, because whilst I'm all right talking to artists, talking to a real hero, you know, he was the world champion at that moment. So he and his wife said, would I care to introduce Bono to them? So I went over to Bono and said, look, you're Damien Hill and Georgie, his wife, want to meet you. They're your neighbors. So Bono said, yeah, fine. And he came over, and Damien Hill grabbed Bono by the arm and said, would you stop lighting fucking bonfires on a Sunday?
Excellent.
And what did Bono say?
He was just totally nonplussed. It was like, yeah, fine. Okay, sorry. Sorry to have inconvenienced you. And that was the end of the conversation.
Love it.
That's fantastic.
I think I've told very quickly my Eric Clapton story. I think I've told it before very quickly, but I had a show on TV called Knock Your Block Off, and all the rock stars, their sons and daughters are watching this bloody thing on ITV, 1987 or so. And I'd met Clapton before because I played in his cricket team earlier, but he didn't really know me. So, but I was known for this bloody show on a Saturday morning. And I was at a polo event. I think Kenny Jones from The Who had arranged it, whatever. So I come out, and I'm walking out, and Clapton's walking out to my right. And so I look at him, and he winks at me, and I wink at him, and I say, Steve Blacknell, Knock Your Block Off. And he looks at me and says, Eric Clapton, Cream, and walked off. and that was our big meeting.
I think one of the really nice things with, if you ever have this situation with an artist, I remember looking after Aswad, I think when I was at CBS, Don't Turn Around and all the rest of it. And then I was at the New Music Seminar probably 8 or 9 years later in a bar in New York, and Brinsley walks in with the band, and it's immediate, John, how are you? And I'm going, that's 9 years history of you meeting different record company personnel, and what a lovely welcome. Yeah. And we spent 4 hours in the bar having a whale of a time.
My connection to Aswad, obviously they were on Ireland. That's where they started.
Yes,
it was that I dropped them. Sometimes when you drop an artist, that can create a really awkward relationship. But years later, Les Spain, the manager, saw some photographs that I'd taken of Billy Ocean. Photography is my passion, my hobby. And I'd taken some photos of Billy Ocean, and he showed my book to Aswad, and I ended up doing a photo shoot for Aswad. And it was just the most bizarre turn of events, having dropped a few years before. And then I became their official photographer.
Did they berate you when you walked in the room, or were they unaware that you dropped?
They said that it was one of the funniest meetings, because I let them go, and they walked out of the room and punched the air as though I'd done them a favour, and then realised, oh fuck, we've just been dropped. 20 years on the label.
Pussycat. Do you know, it's really funny, the 6 degrees of separation, but I think never so much as in the music business, because the last three people you've all mentioned, I have a connection or a story to, and I'm going to do it in a real quick fire way. So Hall & Oates, you say real heroes of yours, Steve. I was on tour with Hall & Oates and had to rescue a girl from his bedroom while her sister was downstairs in the lobby with me. And when I found out how old her younger sister was, I said, we must go up and get her out. So we had to knock on the door, and she eventually came sheepishly to the door. He didn't show his face, but we rescued her. And on the way down the lift, I said, do your mum and dad know you here? And they know we've come to the gig. I said, well, this is 2 hours after the gig at the Midland Hotel in Manchester. And you shouldn't be in the hotel room with a man, let alone a rock star. And how old are you again? And then she told me, and I went, and I got him in the cab and sent them home. I said, never do this again. Eric Clapton, I dated Dee Harrington, who managed Simon Climie, who went on to write and produce dozens and dozens of songs with Eric and albums.
That's right.
And I was dating her for a couple of years in the 80s when he was also living in her flat on a futon, which he'd fold up in the day and then play his synthesizer and compose all his tunes, and then briefly became a Top of the Pops pop legends as Climie Fisher, who had one or two hits. And Aswad, the connection there, Mark, is because when you mentioned their manager, the fabulous Les Spain, Les was one of the key disco club DJs in Liverpool. So when I was promoting and traveling the country, taking white labels and things out, Les was a giant, literally, physically, and as a musical icon in Liverpool. And I spent many a very late hour in the morning at Shabeen's and Watering Holes and After Hours with Les. He's a lovely man.
Lovely man, yeah.
Yeah, really lovely. So there you are, quick roundup.
Just a very quick one before I forget. My first wife in America was called Catherine James, and she was one of the Zappa groupies. So if you remember Pamela DeBar and the... all those plaster castings. Sorry, Dan?
Plaster casters, yes, I was just saying.
Yeah, the plaster. So my first wife was part of that with Pamela and the GTOs and stuff. So, I inherited her husband was Denny Lane. So I inherited as godson, Denny's godson, Damien, who I'm still friends with in America. So, but she was very much part of that. And so she was with Clapton. She claimed, I think she was, the night he wrote Layla and stuff. So I was, aside from all this name dropping, I was from a chap from Dartford in Kent, all of a sudden in these realms of huge superstardom, very odd, and talk about wide-eyed. It's very strange when you meet your heroes, isn't it? And talking of that, Lem, forget about me now. So in the 60s, did you meet some of your heroes? I guess you worked with the Stones, but you must have worked with other people during your time.
Well, I don't know about heroes. There really weren't very many people before. So, you know, I mean, Lonnie Donegan was one.
Well, that will do.
Yeah, that's, I enjoyed meeting him. But I really can't remember anyone else.
So how did you work with Lonnie Donegan, the King of Skiffle?
We just did the gig with him, that was all. And then afterwards I did, I dealt with Marvin Welsh and Farrah. And so that was on the kind of variety circuit.
So were you part of that band?
I was part of the Marvin Welsh and Farrah, yeah.
We did that's in effect the Shadows plus one or something.
Plus John Farrah, yeah.
John Farrah, yeah.
John Farrah, yeah.
Yeah. But that didn't become as big as The Shadows, but I guess it had its moments.
Well, I just did 3 weeks with them. So that was all. So I don't think it actually went any further than that. And then he was off with Olivia, I think.
That's right.
And that's about it, I think, really. I mean, I was getting more into the sort of film world and theatre people because of my friendship with Ian Le Frenet. And so I was meeting, you know, Marty Feldman and all that lot.
That's right. Of course, you knew Marty Feldman, didn't you? That's right. That's correct. Yeah. We have a connection there because I became friends with Loretta in California. We've talked about that. But just going back to the 60s, was the groupie scene and stuff? I mean, was that, I'm talking about my first wife and all that stuff that happened in the 70s with the GTOs and all the groupie stuff. What was the scene like then? Was it as frenetic as that, or was it quite staid, or what was it like?
Well, it was more sort of 15 and 16 year olds screaming and coming on. 14-year-olds, same. I mean, there were no sort of professional groupies at the time. It was just young girls. So it's a totally different scene, especially a completely different scene to America. They were just, you know, girls that would hang out after the gig, and you'd have your way and drop them off wherever, or somewhere.
I know a little about Top of the Pops, but not as much about the show as probably the bands that did it. But when you were doing Top of the Pops, are the stories true about the girls backstage and the dressing rooms and all that stuff?
Well, it used to come from Dickinson Road in those days in Manchester. And, I mean, I think 65, everyone was a little bit staid, and I don't remember any goings on in dressing rooms. I mean, I just remember, first of all, we used to just mime to the whole thing, and then it came where you could you had to sing to a backing track. So I don't remember any girly stories from 65 that I can actually say happened in Top of the Pops.
And so no drinking before even the playback. I mean, which was of the day of the Quos and all those people up there drinking. They would drink before, and especially after, but sometimes before, they went into playback even.
Yes, there was a pub just around the corner. I forget what it was called. And we'd always go in there and have a couple of pints before. And then we'd have to fight our way back through the girls into the studio. Then afterwards, we'd just go off. And there was no, we didn't go clubbing or anything. I mean, we were all quite sensible, really, and it was all very new.
Well, it looked sensible. The 60s bands looked, to Dave Clark Five, just name it, through to the Kinks, just that whole look looked very staid. So you're saying that it was actually quite like that?
Yeah, it was. It wasn't until late in the 60s it started getting a bit, you know, out of hand, if you like. But I mean, everyone was fairly well behaved in the early 60s.
Well, certainly, Mark, you'd know about Quo. I worked with them quite a lot. Certainly the Quo stories of the day, it was very untamed. So I suppose the 60s were staid, gents. And I guess it got a bit wilder for no apparent reason as the 70s came.
Well, I think we look back on the 60s now, because most of the bands wore suits and ties on telly, which probably came from Epstein and the Beatles. It looks staid because it is now in fashion terms. But at the time, I remember my parents were, you know, oh, you don't like the Beatles. Oh, no. And then the Stones came out and it was, oh, my God, you know, please tell me you're not a fan of them, because they were seen as rebels. They were seen as, even though they were wearing suits, parents didn't like pop music. They didn't like the bands. They were scared of the whole thing. And then it was flower power, and then of course the whole world took off. But I think they only look staid now because we think of Suits and Ties as being staid.
But if you look at the performances, there are even like the Birds and stuff, the bands that came over, they are totally and utterly rigid. You know, just standing there was absolutely, if you look at Bill Wyman, the way he was, he sort of, he typified most of the bands of the day, just standing there and just playing.
Well, I've always put it down to the fact that the cameraman or the director said, "There's your mark, don't move." Because they were completely static.
Yeah.
And if you've watched the Ready, I don't know if you're subscribed to the Ready Steady Go Facebook group, but on there you get loads and loads of clips. And actually, it was the American black artists who came over to do Ready Steady Go who dived into the audience and walked around and brought a lot more energy to the whole performance. Most of the Brits were performing like cardboard cutouts.
But also very quickly, I don't know about you, Len, but if you look at the early Top of the Pop performances, drummers like Johnny Coughlin, Kenny Jones, they were always in the forefront of the shot, which was odd. The drummer was always in the front. Well, not always, but very often. And when you speak to one, John Coughlin, he said, "I just don't understand it because I'm so shy and it didn't look very good, but they were always in the front." Do you experience that, Len, with your band or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's always Tommy Moulder being the lead singer was always in shot. And then they used to go to the drummer because I thought it was the most animated.
Yeah, that's probably it. I don't know. Most odd. Just on the subject of drummers, gents, just going around the circle, why are drummers, and even worse, bass players, why are they known as a thing of ridicule? Well, what's wrong with a drummer?
Drummers are normally the first to complain when you're in rehearsals. For whatever reason, they will find something to complain about.
It goes into the orchestra world as well. The percussionists are the bad boys of orchestras, and they're deemed to be the agents provocateurs, even in the orchestral world. It's in the blood. It's the physicality of it, I reckon.
I think it's because they like hitting things.
Exactly, yeah.
Greg, have you got any more stories that you wanted to impart on us?
Well, yes. I mean, another just sort of a bit like the Diana Ross story, just a one-night thing. At CBS, I worked with Michael Jackson a bit. Hang on a sec. Let me just grab the album.
Ah, yes, off the wall.
That's where he got it, yes. Off the wall,
you're
yes.
Doing what Judd did last week. You've brought props. That's not fair.
Well, it's better than a hooker.
So I worked on Off the Wall, and he scribbled on the sleeve for me, which my kids keep trying to nick along with my jukebox. How much is that worth, Dad? You know, we could get some good money for that. I said, well, you can leave that alone until I'm gone. One of my daughters said to me, well, of course, because I'm a musician, a singer, Dad, then I've got the rights to the jukebox. I've got an Ami Continental Mark II, which I did buy off Chris Chappell, but he's now conveniently forgotten that. And because he's living back in England, I think he's going to reclaim it, and he ain't having it because I spent a bloody load of money getting it working and re-chromed. Anyway, so one night, similarly, I've started working on Michael's marketing, but I've never met him. Someone says, Michael's in town tonight. And we start doing TV with him tomorrow and stuff. Could you take him out? I said, yeah, okay. So turn up, pick him up. And there was one night on, it was a Wednesday, and it was a one-off weekly club. I've totally forgotten the name of the club, but it was at the Montcalm Hotel in the basement behind Marble Arch. And there was a very good DJ there, and it was always packed with really cool kids and great music. So I picked Michael up, and came downstairs with just, I think, one or two security guards, but not huge hulks, just very quiet, very sort of in the background, with Mark Lester, his great pal, who was obviously the actor who played Oliver in Oliver Twist. So we go to this club. I've called ahead and we get in. And again, people didn't really
bother VIPs too much in those days, especially if you're in a cool club. I mean, people noticed and were nudging each other and said, that is Michael Jackson. And of course, this is when he was still black before he became white. And people were going, wow, it is Michael Jackson. And we just had a little section in the corner with a red rope, but nothing too fancy. And he wasn't fawned over by the staff. They just thought it was really cool he'd come in there. And he then turned to me after a while. We got a drink. I think he was on juice or something. And he said, you know, Craig, let's dance. So we went out onto the dance floor and danced a bit, and he started moonwalking, and we were practicing moonwalking and stuff. It was like,
you
know, incredible. Anyway, we sat back down, and after a while he disappeared. He and Mark disappeared. And after about 20 minutes, one of his security guys came over to me, and I knew they'd gone off. And he said, Greg, you know, Michael's been gone a while. Can you just check out where? I said, yeah, I know where he is. So I went into the gents, and he was in there with Mark, and they were just sat right at the end of the gentleman's toilets. They just sort of sat up and leaning against the bases, just talking very quietly because it was the quietest place in the club. And I just sort of went in and said, are you okay, Michael? And he said, yeah, we're fine, Greg. You know, we'll be out in a minute. And and fair enough, came out about 5 minutes later, went back out and said, oh, yeah, it's all right. He's just talking to Mark. He'll be back out. And it was quite fascinating. It's widely reported, has been since, is that the reason they became such good friends is because obviously Mark was a child star. And because of Michael's experience, he wanted to get to know people that had had a similar experience. And he bonded very closely with them. And of course, they became godfathers to each other's children. And speculation perhaps even more about the heritage of Michael's children. You've all heard about that one, haven't you?
Yeah.
So that was a night with Michael, and dancing with him was quite fun. Again, no pictures, just wonderful memories.
Funny enough, you say no pictures. I was in Soho about 6-9 months ago at the what's the hotel there? Soho House Hotel.
Yeah. Townhouse Hotel.
Yes, yeah. And I was we were trying to set up a podcast recording there, actually. I was with John, but the guy, one of the guys there said he had the old pictures because the kitchens of the townhouse was originally a nightclub called Gossips.
That's right.
Corner of Mead Street. And if you remember, Greg, Tony Walcott wouldn't give me the budget to do an after party for the Jackson tour, the last of the Victory tour.
Yeah.
I knew the guy who owned it and said, if I bring the Jackson down, they don't drink, but just give them some food. You know, is that a deal? And he said, perfect for me. I'll fill the club up. Doesn't cost me anything in booze. A bit of food's easy. So we did that. And you say no pictures. And they say, this guy about 6 months ago, I was telling him, he said, wait a minute, let me look on my computer. And they had found some original black and white pictures in the club.
No.
Took over, because that is now the kitchen.
Yeah.
Club, and they found some old black and white pictures.
Have you seen them?
I saw one of them, yeah. It was amazing.
Well, when you do, I'd love to see them.
Okay. Well, I think the guy's still got them there. I mean, it's one of the best I know him. So. But,
Remind me why Walcott wouldn't give you a proper budget to do a big bash.
Because Michael hadn't come with Off the Wall at that point. It was the Jackson's Victory album, the Victory Tour. And the record company at that point didn't think that there was any mileage in the band at all.
Oh, how short-sighted of them.
Well, let's face it, CBS in those days didn't really do, and Greg will testify to this, they were still not big in dance music. They didn't think disco. I mean, I tried for years to start a house music label with Muff. Yeah,
you didn't do too well with Muff, did you?
No, he never has.
Yeah. But no, I mean, they were just weren't into dance. Greg will testify to that.
I got it, Steve. Yeah. Good.
Thanks.
There we are.
I've got to, on that explosive moment, I've got to go because my artist, it's our release day. Flora Lynn, enough of you, out through Universal today. I will be mailing you all the link, but we have a series of interviews starting at 6:15. So
I thought you'd spruced yourself up and put a jacket on, Steve.
Yeah, thanks. Cheers. Me spruced. It's my Springsteen look.
Thank you again for hosting this, Steve.
It's been a pleasure.
Are we allowed to carry on without you?
Yes, you are. And if Lem lasts the evening, good luck.
I've got to go as well.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we can.
Your AA meeting, is it, Lem?
Yeah.
All right. Well, no worries. You get off, Lem, if you need to. I want to have a quick word with Greg here. And how are you fixed, Mark? Just 5 minutes. We can have a quick roundup.
Yeah.
This ball.
Ooh. Mark, very Mark, Lem, and Greg, God bless you. Have a lovely weekend, yeah?
Cheers, Steve, and you. Take care.
God bless. See you soon.
Bye, Lem. Bye, Steve.
Bye, Lem.
Bye, John. Bye, John.
See you soon.
Good luck with your muff, Dave. Good luck with your muff. Bye.
You're welcome.
Yeah, cheers. It's been so good. It's been awesome. I just can't get this fucking thing. Oh, there it is. Goodbye.
I can't get out now, so I'll be here for the rest of the night.
Yeah, but he's gone.
Oh, Steve's finally switched off.
Oh, this is great. I love it.
Oh, dear.
No, you're right, Dave. I mean, I was brought in by Jeff Gilbert because they wanted to make the most of all of the rich soul, black, funk music that they had accessible through all the American labels. And I started the CBS Disco Pool, which was a successful attempt to regulate how you promoted records by giving them free to DJs and getting them to plug the hell out of your stuff. And then, you know, artist PAs would happen. And I remember taking Anita Ward to the big gay club in Tottenham Court Road when Ring My Bell was the number one, which was Monster. And we did Top of the Pops. And it really worked well. We sold a lot of singles, and sometimes that led on to albums that for tracks that just couldn't get on Radio One. Mm. You know, because, but then of course look how much dance and soul music's played on the radio ever since those days. And I think
My Soul's phenomenal. What a great radio station.
Mm.
You know,
but I remember when I went in as product manager behind you, Greg, Earth, Wind and Fire's flame, if you like, was not extinguished, but it wasn't going anywhere particularly. And then I remember Malcolm Eid summoned me to his office one day and said, have a listen to this. What do you think? And it was Let's Groove.
Mm,
and I just went, well, Malcolm, please tell me you think it's a bloody smash. And he said, no, I do. But what are we going to do? Because he said, half the people in this company are totally apathetic towards Earth, Wind and Fire because it's been going downhill for a few years.
Mm.
And he said, I don't know what sort of budget you'll get off the marketing. And I went straight back down to Jeff Gilbert and Kate Mundell. And I said, look, you've got to give me some money. And they said, why? I said, just listen to this. It is an absolute bloody smash. It's a top five single in this country. And they've given their due. You know, we made all these beautiful box sets to send round to all the radio stations. And it worked. And then they came in and did Nine Nights at Wembley. But yes, it was really tough because Malcolm even said, you know, you want to get any sort of heavy budget for the black soul act on the label. It was, in terms of marketing, it had just sort of tailed off the whole investment in it.
Yeah. I think actually your story there with Malcolm, the lovely Malcolm Eid and Hugh Atwell and me and Howard, I think there was quite a good synergy between us marketeers and A&R. And A&R knew that most people in marketing really loved music. Like Mark was saying last week, you know, artists tend to forget and that record companies tend to be peopled by people that like music. Not so much maybe some of these days, but back in the day, you got involved with it because by happenstance or by choice or by good fortune or by, in my case, because my dad knew the chairman of EMI and I was fucking around at school and he needed to get me a job. And then I made the most of it. But I think because the A&R fraternity knew that they could find like-minded people in marketing, they would come and ask our advice. And then you could build a team and then you go into the weekly, you know, priority meeting and marketing meeting and start to build a story. Because I think a lot of those middle managements like Jeff and Tony, although I think Jeff did have foresight, they weren't really exposed to dance music and soul music. It wasn't part of their musical history. So they needed other people to tell them what was good.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you should say that because I'd spent 2.5-3 years in head office at WEA before I came to CBS. And at WEA, everyone mucked in. I mean, we were, you could go into any department, sales, press, promotion, whatever, and discuss what was going to happen. What's the plot? And the communication was amazing. It was a smaller team than the CBS team, admittedly. But when I arrived at CBS, I felt that all those operations were very much more segregated, and that it was very difficult to put your point of view forward initially to Hugh and Malcolm. And I think over a period of months, they sort of kind of maybe thought, oh, actually, maybe his ears aren't as bad as we thought, and we'll listen to him. And similarly, you know, vice versa. It's like if someone ever came into my office and said, I think that should be the picture you use on the fly poster. But there wasn't, it got much better while I was there, the communication between the various departments.
Mark, do you have high tension on the island?
Not in my day. I believe that they were on.
There's a great example. I was still working at CBS and ended up doing an after party back to the Jacksons tour again with Michael, and Michael introduced me to High Tension, and I demoed them out of my own pocket.
Did you?
And sent the tapes in and offered them to Muff, who of course immediately turned them down because dance music was never going to work. And I don't know who signed them, but I thought they were signed to Ireland.
They were, but not in my day.
Yeah, fair enough. Anyway, we're gossiping about record days.
which is what it's all about.
Have we got most of the stories down, I think?
This has been utterly fantastic, and I'm really grateful to everyone for coming back for part two after last week's technical disaster.
Can I jump in and just give you a story that I'm just dying to get out? And felt that I'd missed the boat last week. In the early noughties, I did about 6 years managing Richard Ashcroft. Immediately after The Verve. And he was a very difficult customer. His nickname was Mad King Richard because he's Mad King Richard. And he was a very special artist. And sometimes when he performed, it was so brilliant that the hairs on my arms would stand up. You know, he was so on it and so fantastic. And I went on tour with him around Europe, and we were in Mannheim in Germany and did a show. And it was one of those nights that was really, really special. And the audience totally appreciated it. And it was an amazing night. And we got in the blacked out Mercedes van to go back to the hotel. And when we arrived at the hotel, there must have been 300 screaming girls outside the hotel. And you could see Richard just pick himself up, and it was like, yes, this is my moment. And so very rarely for him, he got out of the Mercedes van first with his guitar case. So he had his beautiful Gibson. And as he walked towards the girls with his dark sunglasses on at 1 o'clock in the morning, the girls just fell totally silent. Totally silent. And he walked through this phalanx of 400 girls who were there for Justin Timberlake, who was playing. Anyway, Richard's reaction to the left was the concierge, to the right was reception, and to get to the lift, you had to go around this giant koi carp pond that was inside, full of koi carp, and Richard just stepped over the edge and walked into the koi carp pond, with all these girls looking in through the windows, thinking, who the fuck is this weirdo? And as he walked to the koi carp pond, through the koi carp pond, he didn't realize that it got deeper and deeper. So he's got his guitar here, and then he's got his guitar here, and then he's got his guitar on his head as the water comes right up to his neck with everybody staring at him. And luckily it didn't get any deeper than that. And then he got out the koi carp on the other end, got in the lift, went up, and then totally destroyed his bedroom. Absolutely. The proper rock star, smashed the telly, set fire to the duvet.
Where were you at the time, Mark? Were you walking behind him?
I was following behind, just feet on the
bowling. Honestly, if that was happened today, you'd be filming it for posterity.
I just so wish that I hadn't. Anyway, I just had to get that story out because it's one of many that just sticks in the mind.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that's Bean Rock Tales. We thank Lem Lubin, who has disappeared into the mist. Mark, thank you so much. Neville, Nick, Judd, Greg, Chris, bless you all. Thanks so much for being part. Hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you, Steve.
God bless. See you soon. Keep safe.
Stay safe, and we'll see you soon.
And keep alert.
Not off.
Pop pickers.
Take care. Love to see you.
Yeah, you take care. Thanks for being.
I'll see you soon, I hope. Bye.